Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. In this podcast, we'll explore trends, issues, and events surrounding Lutheran education. In each episode, we'll invite educational experts to shed light on topics that support educators, administrators, and staff. Thank you for listening to LSEM's Lutheran Education Podcast.
And welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. It's great to have you back again. My name is Richard Schumacher. I'm the Senior Director of Operations for LSEM, and I'm the host of today's podcast. And we are really excited to once again re-invite Dr. Kim Markshausen back to the podcast. Kim, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me. I love talking to my peeps, those special ed teachers.
And again, we love having you. Again, it's I've lost track of how many times you've been on the podcast. I know that you're the leader by a wide margin at this point. And again, lots of listeners love to hear what you have to share. So again, it's exciting to be able to be talking to you here again.
Well, again, thank you. I'm glad to do it.
So today, when we first connected with Kim, decided, what topic should we kind of go into? And more or less just say, Kim, what do you want to talk about? Was the way it was formulated. And so, Kim, you chose an interesting topic, something pretty relevant right now to a lot of educators. Why don't I go ahead and just let you kind of cue this up and kick us off with what are we going to talk about today?
Oh, yeah. When you contacted me, I thought, well, let's do a really cheery topic. So let's do learned helplessness. But it's a topic I've been talking to teachers about because we've been seeing more of it since COVID.
And so, first of all, for somebody who's perhaps just new to education or not familiar with the term and the topic, let's just start with a basic definition. When you describe learned helplessness, what are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about a set of behaviors. And it might be good to also point out that we're not talking about a diagnosis. So learned helplessness is, as its name suggests, it's something that you can learn. It's not a personality trait. It's not a diagnosis. It's something that happens because of a set of circumstances. And in some cases, it can happen because of a parenting style. So basically what happens is if a child goes through trauma, then they have one difficult thing after another. And in their brain, they start to think, there isn't anything I can do. And at first, that just applies to that particular situation. But then it can also spread to other things. And that's when we have some difficulties then in school.
So when learned helplessness kind of begins, I mean, again, this is one of those things that it's not something that a child just has or the situation. It's a learned behavior, hence the name.
Right.
What are the contributing factors? Again, you mentioned trauma as being a key one, but just in a household, as a child is growing up, what are some of the things that you're seeing most regularly, most frequently that lead to this the setting in for a student?
Well, if we talk about learned helplessness in terms of trauma, we can easily get examples from COVID. So one of the first times I resurrected this term in my presentation was because I had a group of teachers who were also parents. They were parents of kids who were in high school during COVID. And they had all noticed that their kids had just really stopped making decisions. They, you know, applied for college and then decided not to go. They were spending a lot of time on the couch. The parents were obviously worried they were going to have permanent residence in the basement.
Sure.
And I think that's a great example because for high school students, especially when their mind is on, what am I going to do next? What's coming up? I got to get this down. And all of a sudden, what's normal for them is taken away and there's nothing they can do. Then they develop this learned helplessness. The other way it can show up for younger children, especially, is when you have parents who are overparenting. And that can happen, especially, I think, with parents of children with learning challenges. And I can speak to that from my own experience. Our son was diagnosed with epilepsy when he was 3. And epilepsy tends to come along with learning disabilities, and that was the case for him too. And I remember having to work really hard to not cope for him, to not tell him everything he should do, to not argue with teachers and so forth, and to figure out when do I step in and when do I teach him how to cope. But if you have a parent that's doing all that for you, that's what's going to happen. I had an example of that teaching a college class, freshman honors class, had a student who had an IEP in that class. He had difficulty getting his homework done, and he came to talk to me about it, and he wanted me to solve it for him. And so it's even someone who is as accomplished as he was to get into an honors program was still had learned helplessness about how do I organize my schedule. And so he handled it pretty well when I said, well, what do you think you should do?
So it's interesting you mentioned that again. First of all, this is not something that you necessarily will say students or children between the ages of 3 and 5 will develop. This is something that at any point in time in life, and probably I'm assuming even into adulthood, things can happen that can kind of lead you down the path of finding yourself in that learned helplessness. I'm sure there's probably stories of, you know, 30, 40, 50 year olds who on some level or another are dealing with that.
Yeah, I even see it to a certain extent with my father, who's now 89. And he has just, I mean, this is someone who used to program computers. Mm-hmm. And he's now telling me, I can't set up this portal for my healthcare. You know, he's just, there's just more and more things that he struggles with. And it's becoming easier and easier for him to just hand it over to my sister and brother and I.
And then the second thing that I'm struck with is this learned helplessness seems to me like this isn't just a one person thing to create. It takes two people, because on the one side, there is that person who is asking for, reaching out for the help. But there's another person who is giving that help. Mm-hmm. And again, it's the parent, or like in the case with your father, you just described it, potentially a child, could be a spouse, you know, whatever. With COVID, you know, I want to go back to the example that you gave with the high school students, because again, I mean, it was very unfortunate, you know, high school kids waiting for their senior prom, waiting for graduation and all those traditions that you look forward to and then gone in an instant. And I could see where that would leave the kids kind of reeling and feeling like, well, that's not terribly fair. But I can really see where a lot of parents would have probably been in some ways even more traumatized by that. And then maybe wanting to overcompensate for what was lost. And so does that make sense that it takes two to tango in this case?
Yeah, it really does. It's that kind of give and take. And there's also what the person is hearing from other people too. So if you're in school and you have an IEP and your teachers are, and the IEP people are taking care of everything for you, and they're neglecting to, when you're ready, bring you into the process, that can work that way too. But it's also what you might hear in the news, because a lot of those high school students during COVID, what are they hearing? How far behind are our kids because they're on school online? And none of those high schoolers are thinking every teenager in the world is online school. And so it's okay, we'll get there.
So question that I wanted to throw at here, and we're talking to Dr. Kim Markshausen on the podcast. Learned helplessness in some ways can probably get confused with an actual need that a student has. And I'm really thinking in cases of students with learning needs. Mm-hmm. If you've got a learning disability and you're asking for help because you truly need it, can that get confused with a student who is just trying to, again, see where that parameter is in terms of how much help that I can get? What are the differences between a student who legitimately needs the help asking, or a student who is maybe trying to push the boundaries?
That's an excellent question, because one of the behaviors of learned helplessness is that the child doesn't ask for help. They become so passive that they may refuse to do things. They may refuse to try. They'll get easily frustrated. So if you have a student who's asking for help, it's probably an indication that they don't have learned helplessness. But again, you want to make sure you handle it right. So you want to send it back to them. What are the things that you can do? Is this a time when you really need my help? Because that's okay. But helping them to see that difference and to grow into coping.
So a student with learned helplessness isn't going to ask for the help. What other signs are they going to show you in a classroom that might be an indicator that you've got some learned helplessness going on?
Well, two big ones are refusing to do it and procrastinating, which are brother and sister, actually. Mm-hmm. And both of them are an indication of anxiety, because anxiety is a big factor in learned helplessness, too. Well, that makes sense. If I don't think there's anything I can do to make my situation better, my only response is to feel anxious. And when you get students who are especially passive, or when they say, I can't, or I tried, or their frustration level is so very low, they may be tiptoeing into learned helplessness. And again, that might just be about that one thing. You know, I used to teach kindergarten, and I could tell you in the first 5 minutes working with the child, teaching them how to tie their shoes, who was going to tie their shoes by the end of the week and who was going to take the rest of the semester. Because the ones who just felt like they couldn't do it were having learned helplessness about that one thing. And that's not such a big deal if you've got a kindergarten teacher willing to work on shoe tying all semester, if you've got a good teacher aide. But it becomes a problem if that I can't tie my shoe becomes I can't figure out this math problem, or I can't learn how to jump rope, or I can't talk to my friends.
Any sort of stubbornness that can be kind of confused with this? Again, some kids are just strong-willed and don't want to do that. And again, I'm kind of pointing a mirror at myself here, because when you mentioned the whole shoe tying thing, I was that kid, and you'll be surprised by this, Kim. I was that kid in kindergarten who was told that, well, you can't go on to first grade unless you can tie your shoes. So I waited to the last day of the school year and tied my shoes because I didn't have to bother until then.
You wanted to wait and see if it was worth it going on to first grade.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. Kind of stick the landscape and, you know, keep my options open. You know, so again, I was a classic kid of do it or else. Well, let's see what or else is, because that's more exciting. So there's that stubbornness that can come into that. What are the differences there where you see a student who's just being strong-willed as opposed to having some learned helplessness?
Well, I think what we have to ask is, why is that child being strong-willed? Because it's really easy for us to say a child who refuses to do something, oh, they're just strong-willed. Yeah. Well, sometimes it's because they're not motivated to do it. And I suggest that was your issue. And that's okay. You seem, you know, last time I was with you, you seemed to be able to tie your shoes. So I think it turned out okay for you. But I have found in my teaching that most of the time when a child refuses to do something, they're hiding anxiety. And I found that to be true with the college students that I work with also. And that if I talk to them about it, of course, it's easier to talk to an 18-year-old than a 5-year-old. But we tend to uncover, what is it that you're worried about? So you need to know, what is it? Is this child just totally unmotivated to do this? Now, in terms of tying shoes when you're 5, yeah, that's no big deal. But if we're talking about learning how to read or learning how to interact with your classmates, there's likely to be a natural motivation to do that. And so it may be anxiety.
So when you recognize that student has that anxiety that comes about from that, again, COVID, clearly a huge trigger for students, right, for adults, for a lot of folks over the last, say, 4 or 5 years here. What are some other things that can create that anxiety or are common triggers for that anxiety for students that maybe aren't attached to COVID? I mean, we keep hearing we're getting further and further away from COVID. So what are some other things that might create that?
Well, we talked a little bit about the overparenting. And interestingly enough, someone who overparents creates anxiety because they are over and over again telling the child, you can't do this. I need to do it for you. I mean, they're not saying that out loud, but that's the message. So that can cause anxiety. We're also just in general seeing children with more anxiety, and that may be may not be connected to COVID. It may be how adults have changed since then. It may be a generational thing. But just in general, anxiety can lead to that. It's interesting that when I talk about the fight, flight, or fright response, that one of them is to refuse to do something. So that's a fleeing kind of thing. I'm just not going to do it. So when we see that in students, it typically means they're in anxiety mode. They're in their sympathetic nervous system, and we want to help them to get into their parasympathetic nervous system to tell their brain they can calm down a little bit.
So as students are struggling with that, obviously, academic issues are going to fall into place here because, again, if they're just not committed to trying to learn, you're going to see that pretty quickly in the academic side of things. What are some of the behavioral ramifications that can come into play with students, especially younger students, where that social learning is so important?
Well, yeah, because if they're passive, they're not going to be engaging with others, are
No.
they?
No.
And in terms of the cognitive effects, it's even more than academics, because the more they're participating in that learned helplessness and the more they are perceiving messages from others that say, you know, if I get impatient and just do it for the child, I'm giving them a message then, the more they're wiring their brain to think that they can't do it. And so the behaviors then tend to be the being passive and easily frustrated. Those are most of the behaviors. I'm not sure that you would see children acting out, because that's not passive, that's aggressive, isn't it? That's probably a different issue. But my bigger concern is this child will be training themselves to think there isn't anything I can do. And good special education teachers know that with nearly every disability, there's a superpower. There's something else that they can do well, and we really don't want it to move into that and convince them that they can't do other things.
So another impact that I think you can see with this learned helplessness, especially with students who are withdrawing, is the friends that they have. They're not going to necessarily understand why all of a sudden this friend of mine is so quiet, isn't interacting, engaging. And again, they're just going to move on and probably just build friendships and hang out with other friends. And then that can kind of begin to create some additional isolation, additional feelings of anxiety, because now I don't even have friends now. So how does a teacher perhaps combat that or encourage other students? I mean, hard to tell a 7-year-old to be on the lookout for these things, but is it important for teachers to encourage the other students to go ahead and keep playing with that student? You know, don't leave them go there. They just need you to kind of initiate it. Now, what do you suggest in that sense?
Well, and that makes a big difference at what the age is, you know, because if you've got a classroom of 3-year-olds, you're telling everybody that. And if you have a classroom of 12-year-olds, you have to be more subtle in that approach. I think it's good that you brought it up, because this is an important area of learned helplessness for students who are on the autism spectrum, because they're a good example that they may have a failure after failure after failure in their social interactions, because that's weak for them and might just give up. And then, of course, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because now they think nobody wants to play with me anyway. I suspect that it's a good thing for younger children to talk to the other kids and say, here's what we're doing to help this child, because you can get away with that with early childhood. You can say, you know, Billy's having some doubts that he can do this, and so we're going to encourage him and we're going to make sure he comes to play. But for older kids, I suspect it's going to have to start with dealing with that learned helplessness. And once you've dealt with that, then other things open up, because learned helplessness itself is not a diagnosis, but it can lead to depression. And that's really going to impact social relationships.
All right, we're talking to Dr. Kim Markshausen on the Lutheran Education Podcast here, discussing learned helplessness and, again, what we're seeing, post-COVID. When it comes to the COVID responses that we've seen, again, EANS and GAPS and all sorts of other acronyms, sent a lot of money down the pike toward helping schools continue to go. And again, a lot of blessings from all of that. But in looking at a lot of those things, while schools had options to choose a lot of ways to go with the funding that they received, getting this far down into the weeds of, dealing with students who are having these emotional responses, these anxiety responses, not a lot of schools got down that far with it. The money didn't quite stretch that far. And in some of these cases, money's not the answer to solving a situation like that. Has there been any resources or any organizations that you're aware of that have kind of stepped up offering ideas and providing information, of course, besides, Kim Markshausen?
Yes.
What are some of the places that the teachers can turn to get some help and some advice on dealing with this?
I think your best bet would be to find a school psychologist or a school counselor, because they are closest to this and they're aware of it very much. I have a good friend who's a school counselor, and we've had a lot of conversations about it. So they're going to know the kinds of things that can be done. If you have a child that needs some help, I would recommend helping the parents to find a therapist who does cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's sometimes called CBT. It's, first of all, the kind of therapy that actually has a strong research base. So it's not something new or something kind of frou-frou out there. Mm-hmm. But also, it will tackle the things the child is thinking in his or her head that need to be addressed. And a good CBT therapist will help the child to identify the things they're thinking and give the child and the parents ways to cope. And if you're a teacher, I would say document these behaviors, document, especially if it's a change that you're seeing or if it's spreading, document those passive behaviors and how they won't try, and document what you've tried. Have the parent take that along to the therapist and make that therapist tell you some things to do too. Because I remember sending kids to therapy, and then I would just get, well, here, you need to do this sticker chart, and I wouldn't really get something that's helpful. But that would be a big area of help.
And we're going to talk about more ideas and suggestions on how to help students who are dealing with this learned helplessness and the anxiety that surrounds it after we take this short break. We'll be right back with Dr. Kim Markshausen on the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries.
Lutheran Special Education Ministries is an organization committed to serving schools, churches, and families to advance the success of children who have learning needs. Our commitment to this mission began with the opening of the Lutheran School for the Deaf in Detroit. Over the years, our ministry has expanded, and today LSEM is proud to serve in Lutheran schools across the country. But as our ministry has grown, our commitment to helping students succeed academically in an environment where they can also grow spiritually is as strong as ever. So if your church or school is looking for professional development for your faculty, information to share with struggling families, or for a ministry partner to support an existing resource room or start a new one, LSEM is ready to help you meet your specialized learning goals. For more information about how LSEM can help you build brighter futures for your students, please contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. That's www.luthsped.org.
And welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Dr. Kim Markshausen. Kim, once upon a time, you had mentioned that you were blissfully unemployed. That's still the case, or have you found your way into some gainful employment these days?
Yeah, chronically unemployed is a good term for it because I just kind of go from one contract to the other. But I am now teaching for the University of Nebraska. I teach for their honors program. And as I mentioned before, they're all freshmen, so it feels a little bit like kindergarten.
So I'm imagining based on the football season this past year, learned helplessness is something that you've dealt with
football team there. Rub that in.
did I mention Michigan won the national champion?
I think I heard that.
If you're familiar with the podcast, you know that Kim and I have had these discussions before. So it just seemed appropriate to toss that in here as we get started. And please send all the correspondence you'd like to Jim Harbaugh. He's in Los Angeles. All right. So learned helplessness. Again, we left off before talking about just beginning to talk about some of the things that that teachers can do, ways that they can kind of assist and help in this process. And as we've been talking, we've mentioned that this is something that can impact people, whether they're very young or very old. So I'd like to kind of start with, again, reactions and responses that teachers can provide to their students. And let's start with those early childhood years. So our ECE teachers that are out there, what are the things that they should be doing to try and help to either avoid or to help to support better behaviors in this regard?
I think for teachers working with any age group, the first thing that we need to do is be sure we understand what's behind the behavior. Because as we talked about earlier, a lot of these behaviors can seem like there's something else. And so early childhood teachers, I think, are very good at observing. We have to be because we have to kind of read their minds. And so that observation and noting that there's a behavior change or noting that this child is not doing anything from being able to take off their coat to carrying their own backpack, any of those kinds of things. And so when you get enough observations, then you realize this child seems to have learned helplessness, then what you want to do is address that in a way that helps the child to learn how to cope. So I'll give an example from when I moved from teaching first grade down to kindergarten and experienced a new phenomena, which it was kindergartners are sometimes afraid to come to school. That was never an issue with first graders. But my first instinct was, you know, they're so cute. They're so sweet. I'm just going to scoop them up. We're going to go sit in the rocking chair and rock until they feel better. But after a while, I realized that worked in the short term, but it wasn't solving the problem in the long term. And what I was doing was unwittingly telling that child, oh, you sweet thing. Yes, you do have something to be worried about because here I am willing to comfort you. And so what I had to learn to do was to not dismiss their feelings, because if I dismiss the fact that they're worried, they will continue to be worried. So we needed to accept their feelings and then remind them that things are going to be okay, and then teach them a way to cope. And so the way that would look would be a child would come in and they'd be clinging to mom, and I'd take the child by the hand and kneel down and get, you know, eye to eye with them and say, I can see that you are a little bit worried about school today, but you and I both know that your mom would never bring you to a place that isn't safe. So that doesn't solve the problem. It just reminds the child about the love of that parent. And then I would stand up again and look around the room and say, what can you find to do that will help you to feel better? So acknowledging that emotion, pointing it out to them, because they don't often know, they just know they're afraid, reminding them that they are safe, that they or that they can do this. You know, I've seen you do this before, so I think you can try it again. And then asking them, what is something that will help you to cope? Now, you may end up giving the child the way to cope, and that's okay. But by first asking them, you are giving them the strong message that I have confidence that you can do this. So if we're looking at a child, early childhood child who's afraid to maybe go to the block area and tell the friends there that he wants to play too, then your response is going to be similar. I can see you're a little bit worried about this, but I've seen you with your friends before and you've been able to talk to them. What do you think you could say? Now, that's a long step-by-step process that we do for early childhood because they don't have those models in their head yet anymore.
And before we move up the grade scale here, I'm gonna ratchet up the degree of difficulty.
Oh, good.
So that student who's coming in, who's demonstrating a fear of wanting to be in kindergarten, again, scooping them up, taking them to the rocking chair, wasn't the best approach. But in the scenario you gave me, the mom who brought the child in is standing back and letting the teacher step mm-hmm. in and do the active corrective measures to get them where they need to be. What if mom is coming in and she's doing a little more than she should, and she's not getting the hints and maybe doing things that she really shouldn't because she's making the problem worse? How do you then, as the teacher, step into that scenario where you've got to not only help the child, but help the mom?
Right. And I like how you said the mom's not getting the hint, because obviously you're going to try this method a couple of times and most parents will, okay, she wants me to step back. They'll get that. And that would obviously, the situation you're describing would be, that needs to be a conversation just between mom and teacher, or dad and teacher, or grandpa and teacher, whoever is bringing them in, because you wouldn't want to confront them in front of the child. Right. You'll make them feel defensive, or they may accuse you of not caring about the child. We've all heard those kind of things before. But to meet with that parent again and say, you know, you and I are having some challenges here helping your daughter to be comfortable in kindergarten. Now, I say it in exactly that way so that I'm not putting it on mom or dad, right? And it's also accurate. This is a problem that we're both having. So let's talk about what we need to do. And then again, if mom's overdoing or dad's overdoing, I would say, what do you think is the best thing for your child? And, you know, when you make them think about it and they're not just reacting, 9 times out of 10, they come up with the right answer and then they can understand better.
Yeah, again, I love, there's always two things that I always would tell my staffs as a principal when you're trying to reach these sorts of things, and you nailed them both in here. The first one is to come alongside. Again, it's right. never an accusatory finger point where, you know, you as the parent are creating the problem, nor is it the puffed out chest saying, I am going to solve mm-hmm. the problem. It always has to be, let's come together. And I love the way you asked that question. I know you turn around, what would you do? It's seeking understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, those questions are never, you know, right or wrong per se, as much as they're, help me understand from your right. perspective. And as a parent, you know, that's a whole lot safer environment to start a conversation than, like you said, a question that makes them feel defensive or like they failed in some way, you know, like they're on trial now. So I love that, because again, seeing that work, and again, that works, you know, from K to 12 yeah. and, you know, and far beyond that.
And I like that it makes parents think, because when they're reacting in the moment, they're reacting from their own anxiety. I wish my child would just go to kindergarten, you know? Yeah. But now you're asking them what you think we should do. You make them think when they're in a calmer state.
Yeah. And again, working together, they're going to always look back at the teacher as being, okay, caring, concerned, you know, willing to go the extra mile, fair, all those terms that, again, on those base levels, you want that. Because again, when you've got that built into the relationship, then if things do get more difficult, it's a lot easier to wrestle those bigger challenges. So let's move it up the ladder here a little bit. You know, let's get out of the early childhood, get into that elementary school age. So, you know, we're talking about Lutheran schools here. So the, say, 3rd to 8th grade, you mm-hmm. know, what are the changes perhaps that you might need to do in your approach with the student or the parent at that age level?
Well, with a student, I just modify the same kind of procedure. And really, what that's called is empathy refrain. And the empathy part is very important because if I dismiss that student's feelings, so if I got a student who say, I can't do this math assignment, if I just dismiss it and say, oh, yes, you can, try again, well, I'm only going to make that anxiety worse. I'm only
Sure.
going to reinforce that learned helplessness because now they're anxious and they try again and it's not going to work again. So the first step is always to empathize. And I think even all the way up through eighth grade, it's a good idea to point out what you think their emotion is. You look at elementary students at about age 9, 10, 11, they're going through a major brain change. And that's what makes the adolescent years oh so very fun. And then you put hormones in on top of that. As a former principal, you know that combination.
Oh, yes.
They are relearning about their feelings because when they're little, they're learning about their feelings just from themselves. When they're older, they're learning about their feelings in relationship to others. So to say, I can see that you're frustrated, or even make it a little easier and say, if I were you, I would feel frustrated. Because sometimes, when you get to middle school and say, I think you're afraid, well, no, they're
Yeah.
going to be defensive, just like that parent. So you can change that a little bit and say, if I were in that situation, I know it would make me feel. How does it make you feel? Let them sit in that emotion a little bit. Because any kind of anxiety or learned helplessness means I'm not dealing with the emotion. I'm moving on. I'm just going to give up and move on. And so if you let them sit in that emotion a little bit and say, what are you worried will happen? Or how does this make you feel? Because adolescents especially need to learn how an emotion makes them feel in their body. And if you're working with middle schoolers, and there's a lot of people in the class that have trouble with that, I would recommend that those classroom devotions focus on the lament psalms. Because King David, especially, like if you look at Psalm 6 and Psalm 13, he described his emotions beautifully. So here's a warrior who's not afraid to say, I'm crying so much, my bedclothes are soaking wet. And to do that with those middle schoolers and let them know, you need to feel that emotion. And then once you can identify it and you can feel it, now you can reframe things. Now you can move on to those statements like, what do you think you could do about it? Or reframe the whole situation and say, I know this is frustrating, but I also know that it's an opportunity to learn. So you're telling the brain, this isn't just horrible, this is also a good thing. Now you can't leave it there and say, well, you're feeling frustrated. I hope you learn something from that and move on. But to plant that idea in the brain that you have an opportunity to learn how to solve a problem, now we can talk about what do you think you can do to cope? And again, you're back to if they can't think of it, then you suggest some things and say, you need to pick because you're the one who knows. Now, that's exactly what I did with the college student. We talked about three different ways that he could get his homework done on time. And I said, you have to pick because you know what's going to work for you.
We're talking with Dr. Kim Markshausen about learned helplessness and kind of going through the different age levels. So you've reached the student, and again, you've asked good questions and have gotten them engaged in kind of thinking through the solutions that work for them. So they've now accomplished it in that particular case. There's always this desire to come back around and then offer, praise and encouragement and whatnot. What would you recommend in that sort of term? How quick should you give that? How often, how long? Don't want to turn it into something that's forced or fake or over the top, but don't want to also ignore it either. So where would you recommend teachers go in terms of that follow-up?
That's an excellent question because if we use the kind of praise we typically do, the easy kind of praise, which is, hey, good job on that spelling test. That is exactly what someone with learned helplessness doesn't want to hear because they're still at the beginning, and in their brain it's going to be, okay, I got a better grade this week, but next week I'm going to be a failure again. And so we want to follow what Carol Dweck tells us to do, which is to praise the effort. So you've got a student who's a lousy speller. Well, I can relate to that because I'm a lousy speller too. And you study really hard, you find something that works, and you've improved your grade from a D up to a C. Instead of saying, good job on the spelling test, you say, man, your extra work made a difference. Let's stop and think, what exactly worked? Because I know you tried three different things. What do you think worked? So now you're praising them for overcoming their learned helplessness a little bit. And that's a good thing to praise them for. But you're also planting in their head, you are able to find a solution to this problem. You are able to get the help you needed. That's going to come back up again in the brain the next time they have something difficult.
And I like how, again, you always keep bringing that encouragement back to the student self-directing where they go from there. Again, great job, done. And the next time it is or it isn't. But the fact that, hey, the work that you did really paid off, you know, and then that reflective question, you know, how, you know, what's next? How do you continue that? You know, that's I think, a really great tip, because, you know, the easiest thing in the world to say is, ah, good job, and oh, it's fixed. And then as a teacher, walk on to one of the other, you know, dozens of issues that you can focus on. So,
and learned helplessness is not going to be corrected overnight. You know, if you've got a student in your class, you're going to be working on this for the entire year. And that's okay, because you're building good structures into the brain.
You talked about this whole idea of empathy reframing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in terms of it being empathy, again, it, you know, it's not that you're feeling sorry for the student, or you're going to, in some way, shape, or form, you know, well, let me make this easier for you, whatever. Again, because again, when folks hear the word empathy, I think there's sometimes perhaps a lead towards sympathy. And that's not what you're saying here, because again, that's heading right back to the learned helplessness, and it's going to feed that.
That's so, scooping them up and taking them to the rocking chair.
So again, in terms of doing that empathy reframing, well, again, more suggestions or ideas of ways to demonstrate that in the interactions with the students.
Well, and it's really a simple process. And I found too in the classroom that even with 5 and 6 year olds, if I would do it out loud, the other kids would pick up on it because it's something that the brain likes. Mm-hmm. And then they'll come back and remind you. But just that that 1-2 step of identifying what the feeling is, identifying what the problem is, and announcing, yep, we're having difficulties with this. And then finding what's the good thing that's involved in there. Is this an opportunity, or is there something the child's doing well? I can see you're frustrated, but you're staying calm. Even that's a reframing and pulling out a good thing. The reason why this is important is because when we go through a difficult experience, we have a situation that's called hot cognition. We've got strong emotions, and our brain is really very strongly encoding that experience. If it's negative every time, we're moving more and more toward learned helplessness. But if we encode that frustrating experience with a little bit of joy or a little bit of hope, then our brain is not only going to remember frustration, it's going to remember hope. And it's going to remember the person that helped. And so then the next time a problem happens, the brain's going to pull back up from the memory, this is what we did last time we were frustrated. Oh, wait a minute, there was hope. Oh, wait a minute, there was someone to help. And if you're doing that as a teacher with the whole class, it's not just going to be you that's the person to help. It's going to be someone else. And now we're wiring that brain to be in fellowship, aren't we? To be ready to accept help and give help to each other, which is part of what God intended.
I was just going to say, and you've just described what I think every Lutheran educator wants their classroom and their school to be like. And what a better place for us to be able to share that than in a Lutheran school. And during the break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, that idea of how Lutheran schools are uniquely set up to be able to provide these types of things. So it was your statement, so I'm gonna let you go ahead and take it. I want it to sound like I'm coming up some brilliant here, but how does that connection work there? What do you see there that makes the Lutheran school setting so unique to be able to help with this?
I think it's an important question to address, because time and again we see how Lutheran schools especially, but Christian schools too, the kids tend to test better than in the public school. And we know it's not because we've got all the smart kids. You know, if we had all the kids who were easy at learning, we wouldn't need LSEM, would we?
No,
so
we
have as many of those, and I've supervised in public schools, we have many of those kind of kids. For me, what makes the difference is that integrating the faith. And that's not just about talking about Jesus during math class, it's about using those aspects of our faith to help us to be better learners. When we use empathy and reframe with a student, we are acknowledging a failure, basically. We're not sweeping it under the rug, we're acknowledging it, and we're talking about what you can do about it. That also spreads to the kinds of things where we would need to repent. Because in a child's mind, and I think it's also true for adults, there isn't a difference between getting a bad grade on a spelling test and breaking a rule out in the playground. They're all a failure. And if you have a child who is constantly having trouble in the playground, and that's never addressed, and they're not forgiven, and they're not learning how to cope, they're going to develop a learned failure about how to treat their friends. It all brings together. So in the Lutheran setting, when we can say, I'm sorry, and be encouraged to repent, and our teacher or our friend says, you are forgiven. And then we hear it again in chapel, and we hear it again at devotions, and we hear it again in the Bible stories about how Jesus died and rose again for us. That is a learning that goes so deep in the brain. Those are such strong neural pathways that it's very easy for that understanding of repentance and forgiveness to just step over into how I'm doing academically, how I'm doing in my social skills, how I'm doing just growing and learning and surviving adolescence or daycare or wherever I'm at.
Excellent. That is a great place to, I think, to wrap that up. Again, what a phenomenal thought, what a phenomenal opportunity that we have. And again, thank you for sharing that. So again, talking with Dr. Kim Markshausen. Kim, if anybody listening to this podcast wants to connect, wants to get more information, ask a question, or help you with your chronic unemployment,
yes,
how would they best go about getting a hold of you?
Easiest way is kim@markshausen.net. kim@markshausen.net is the easiest thing to remember. But I also have a website in that same domain. And so you can find and email me. And yeah, I love hearing those questions, because it helps me to know what teachers are dealing with. And yes, I love coming to speak too, if somebody needs that, or popping in on Zoom, whatever works.
And again, I can vouch, Kim has been a very popular speaker across the different districts of the LCMS. I've seen her at teacher conferences, big and small, and has done marvelous work in sharing on this topic and a lot of topics. So again,
Well, I have to tell you that when I taught that freshman honors class, I finished the class, and you know, college students, it's the class is done. They're thinking about what's coming up next, Christmas break, right? I turn back around and I have 5 college students who want to give me a hug. So I think I'm just everybody's grandma. So go ahead, ask me whatever you want. I'm everybody's grandma.
All right, that tag is going to stick. And the next time we talk, we'll probably bring that up. So look forward to that. Kim, thank you very much. Always appreciate you taking the time and sharing the wisdom. Again, thank you for everything you do for our Lutheran schools and for talking to us here on the podcast.
And thank you too for your ministry. And also thank you to all those teachers out there listening, because what you do is very important.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Thank you to everyone who's listening to the podcast. And again, thank you for those of you who are subscribing and are listening on a regular basis. Again, we are really pleased to be able to bring this to you and look forward to speaking to you again. But for now, thank you to Kim and Dave, our producer. I'm Rich Schumacher, and you've been listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. For more information on this episode's topic or any other questions regarding Lutheran education or Lutheran Special Education Ministries, please feel free to contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I praise you, Lord.